And then they have Devil's Night every day after Halloween. It'd be like 2,000 fires across Detroit. You'd see them from Windsor.
Bert, what yeah. more stuff do you get in your studies this week?
Hey, Bob, I was reading, I'm going through the Don Thiel, the digital culture chapter, Joyce Light and the Road to Digital Culture. And
yeah.
there was a reference to Thiel made about McLuhan and Joyce regarding light, sound, and communication. And it had me thinking about you and Roxanne were questioning Ion about the Emerald Tablets and the circle plane and sound.
Yeah.
And the question for you is that circle plane and sound, would that also transfer over to what Thiel was discussing with McLuhan and Joyce about light, sound, and communication?
Yeah, that's verbi vocal visual is the phrase from Phineas Wake. I was actually thinking about that, verbi vocal visual. Verbi, speech, vocal, sound, and visual. Eye, ear, and maybe tactility. Verbi and vocal are pretty similar.
Because it just, because I remember Ion never really picked it up when you were pushing it about the circle plane and sound
right.
reference,
right.
when you were referencing that those three elements that are a part of our makeup actually overlay or relate more so than the 12 body systems of the body. And I've just been thinking about that since I heard that. And when I read that, it opened up more thought. Because it's pretty fascinating how you presented that, and then you read the Emerald Tablets, and then Thiel's commentary on light and how the different ways that Joyce and McLuhan reference to light, it stimulates thought with me, well, how your relationship, how you've always talked about cold fusion or referenced cold fusion, and then thinking of Ion and what Ion represents, or what Ion is, or, you know, there's, it opens up a whole nother way of looking at it, and that's what I was just asking. So you said it does relate to.
Right. And you're saying, you're talking about light itself, how Thiel comes
yes.
into the different aspects of light.
Yes. Yeah. And he sort of talks that McLuhan didn't really touch on the depth and complexity that Joyce used within the wake
yeah.
and
yeah.
how McLuhan used just certain points of it to prove his point, which, you know, it makes sense, but it's just so, for me, I find it fascinating because it, I mean, when I read about James Joyce, I see things, but then I also read McLuhan, but then to roll it up into what you do with your chart, how you outlined it with your chart, and then just how you actually are expanding that. I mean,
yeah.
just from your what youth, you hide the what youth. There are some really interesting themes that it's a shame that a lot of people aren't listening, but it doesn't matter to me because I get something out of it. But it's just
yeah.
that Web 2.0 and what Web 1.0 and how that changed, and there's no now. And there's something you said at the end that you people were to create their own contrast. So I'm really not bringing a theme. I'm just like spitting out stuff that I was thinking this week after listening to it. But it's just
that you noticed it.
Yes, it's just fascinating.
Well, maybe we should bring Sarah in here, Sarah Courtney. So, are you still here, Sarah? Let's see.
Yes, I'm here.
No. So,
here.
Why don't you go into some of your thoughts that you emailed me about? Sarah's looking into some of this stuff too. What were you reading?
I most recently about light. I was I had seen a little article about some scientists that are investigating Van Gogh's painting Starry Night,
right.
And they the way it's the color, the juxtaposition of color in the painting, and the spacing of the different bands of color give it a vertical movement to the eye. And so I was relating that to actually also Finnegan's Wake, because when you read it, it almost has the same effect on you as looking at some other, you know, pieces of artwork. I think they identified some other pieces of artwork, too, that have caused that vertical movement of the eye, and actually predicts, they went to further and said it predicted chaos theory somewhat. And so relating that to the chaosmos and all of that, but feel and...
oh, yeah, the boiler room.
You're talking about the music.
Yeah. Now, the boiler room, I went and looked at that, and I opened the show with a boiler room excerpt. Maybe you didn't hear the beginning, right? The music?
I might have missed that one.
Yeah, it was, you sent me two links, and one of them was the one I used, where the kids are sitting around watching the DJ. And I wonder, you know, they like these beeps and bops, and I wonder what they would make of, if I just played what I do on the show, what they would make of that. Would it be too semantic, too many English words? Like, they respond to, like, tactile beepings, boinkings, and bompings.
That's,
you know,
the electronica.
Right.
The one you played?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They look a bit drugged out.
You think that's what? Yeah, they're just kind of swaying. It's kind of like their chemical body is lazy. They haven't got much energy in the chemical body, so they just sort of sway. That's their dancing. Compare that to the 30s.
And they're passing bottles around and all drinking out of the same bottles. It's weird.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Their lips are touching the same rims.
They're just passing it around like a joint or something. Bottles,
right,
and cans.
So nice, pleasant music. So I start off the show with that, like we're starting a boiler room. So this is the new phenomenon, Chad.
I've been listening to Boiler Room for like a year.
1 year?
Yeah, it's been around.
You're listening to a show called that, or what is it when you say you're listening to Boiler Room?
There's a channel on YouTube where they have all those Boiler Room events. Yeah.
And it shows people hanging around?
Mm-hmm. They're all kind of the same concept.
They're all what?
Yeah, they...
They're all kind of the same concept.
The same. Yes, the different shows.
Mm-hmm. It started.
There's a DJ in the middle.
Yeah, they kind of just promoting new music, new artists, but they would film it. Like, I think they're on the website. It says they just, the first time they did it, they just taped a camera on the wall and videotaped it and live streamed it. So they're like little mini raves, sort of, in small settings, and they're live streaming it. But you can see the crowd interacting with the DJ, usually.
Yeah. And do they go on for many hours, these shows?
Yeah, they usually go on
for like 4 hours.
So where are these people? Is this in L.A. or something?
They're everywhere.
No, it's all over the world.
All over the world.
Oh, different studios.
No, different clubs.
Clubs. Hmm. Yeah, there was one of them. There was this short, cute girl with her beer just swaying, and then another guy got talking to her. And then he moved her out of her position, so he got to stand behind the DJ. But I didn't notice that he's passing around bottles. That was disgusting to you, eh, Sarah? You would never do that.
No, it's just, I don't have an opinion about it. I'm just, I was noticing what these pretty young looking kids were doing. And like you said, they were just standing there kind of bopping around. They looked like, you know, they weren't really, they were, I guess they were kind of interacting with each other, some of them. That girl was kind of hanging off different guys.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way, they would just pass certain things around. But a lot of them were just holding up their phones, kind of videotaping the DJ, the back of the DJ.
Yeah.
Thought that was weird. But they have them now, like, every music festival that's in New Orleans here will have a room. So, like, at Buku, they had the Blue Room, or I forget what it was called. So it's usually a small little warehouse area, where they'll set aside, and they have that music streaming online, and it's kind of the same thing, a DJ, and mostly electronica music.
Mm.
But sometimes it's live bands, but...
So what Red Bull sponsors this?
Well,
I think they have different sponsors. Like, yeah. I've seen them even in, like, Mexico and Brazil, and, yeah, they're all over the place. Different sponsors, different. It's not just clubs either. Sometimes they have it out on the beach, kind of, at night.
Yeah.
Next to the beach.
I'm on their website, Bob. It's Boiler Room TV. They have, like, 65 locations. It's a community to world's leading community of underground music fans. They have 65 locations in the world.
And they're always streaming.
Yes, it looks that way. Yes. Berlin, London, New York, Paris, Los Angeles, Amsterdam, Mexico City, Tokyo, Warsaw, Moscow, Brazil, Melbourne. Or the headlines, but you can open it up and see all 65 locations.
Right. Where do you click on?
It's cities. It's just
cities.
Boiler Room TV.
No, I'm there.
Boiler Room. Are you there? And if you look at the bottom, it says see all 65 locations. If you scroll down, it's almost at the end. You can see all 65 locations.
See all 65, right.
Another one I linked to in my email.
24/7?
Yeah, pretty much. But they had, they were streaming from South by Southwest, which is going on now in Austin. Maybe it ends today.
They only get Vancouver for Canada, no Toronto. Oh, no, they have Toronto. Well, what can we do next?
you're skipping around a lot.
What, in general?
Yeah, you were going to do Dumbo. Alan Cabal.
Oh, yes, Alan Cabal. Let's do him. Okay. Everybody got the article? SpliceToday.com, an antipathy for junkies. Did you hear me do him, Chad, in previous shows? Did you hear me talking about my life with him?
I'm not sure. Is that the guy who wrote the book called Fuck Face or something? Or someone else?
No. No, he... He interviewed me for New York Press.
He had the article that mentioned fuckface a few times.
Oh, yeah, he didn't write the book. He wrote the article where the iPhone started saying, hey, fuckface,
yeah,
on everybody's iPhone. Okay, so his girlfriend through the 2000s was Daisy. So he goes back to Daisy. Daisy's 38-year-old junkie son is coming down from Rhode Island. So this is now. We're hearing his latest story and the people he's involved with. You guys are laughing? I haven't even started. Okay.
I'm remembering the previous articles. I remember Fuckface.
Right,
laughing
right.
At Fuckface.
Daisy's 38-year-old junkie son is coming down from Rhode Island claiming he wants to get clean. So it's interesting we're reading about Rhode Island today, and Sheila's from Rhode Island, and today she got married. So there's the tie-up. He got busted last October after smashing his car up while in possession of several bags of smack. He's had 6 months to get clean. Junkies lie all the time. Never trust a junkie. My hatred of junkies borders on the pathological. Heroin addicts arouse a deep, visceral loathing in me based entirely on experience and reason. It's a Darwin thing. It's also related to my affair with crystal methamphetamine, which went on sporadically from 1968 to 1995. Anybody over 40 who uses refined white powder stimulants is begging for a heart attack. Drug use is a discipline. It's a form of yoga. Drug abuse is Darwin in action. Drug abuse is Darwin in action. I was about 10 years old when I started stealing the occasional cigarette from my mom and smoking in the stairwell of the Esplanade at 74th Street and West End Avenue in Manhattan, where we lived at the time. At 13, back in Camden, New Jersey, I started stealing my father's Librium and my mother's Darvon and Dexedrine. At 14, in February of 1968, my buddy Danny and I, remember Buddy? He's the guy who had bad teeth, if you read some of the older articles. He goes to see Danny. Danny's in bad shape last year, 2014.
Oh, that's right, in New Jersey.
Yeah, at 14 in February 1968, my buddy Danny and I skipped school and hiked from East Camden to Kramer Hill in the freezing cold to cop our first bag of pot from Frank and Andrea, two enterprising junkies that dealt everything they could get. That was the day I slammed my first spoon of meth. I was a garrulous kid, and Frank and Andrea thought it would be funny to see what a shot of meth would do to me. The initial rush was amazing. For the first few minutes, I felt like George God riding on a rainbow. That's some character, George God?
I've never heard of him.
No, I've never heard of him.
For the first few minutes, I felt like George God riding on a rainbow. Then I clammed right up and doodled in a notebook with a felt tip marker for about 3 hours while we all smoked pot. They were amazed at the paradoxical effect. I watched Frank and Andrew get off on heroin. It gave me the creeps. Danny and I split after that. A couple of weeks later, Frank got shot by a biker he'd ripped off, and Andrea took it on the lam to points unknown. I found better connections, hipper connections, uninvolved with heroin. I avoided junk and junkies throughout my tenure as a speed freak and acid head. I cultivated an elitist disdain, correctly perceiving them as thieving, lying lowlifes tending towards bad hygiene. My social circles were LSD-centric. We were pursuing higher awareness, not analgesia. Meth is not truly addictive, and I could take it or leave it. Mostly I took it. I couldn't understand how somebody could become addicted to a drug like junk. I was a voracious reader and kept myself informed about the drugs I was using and drugs in general. I was familiar with the works of Aldous Huxley, R. Gordon Wesson, Tim Leary, Ken Kesey, John Lilly, and the startling genius of Art Kleps. I was also reading a lot of William S. Burroughs, whose works are pretty raw and explicit as regards the horrors of heroin addiction. I hung out and corresponded with Burroughs a bit during the 80s. He was appalled by the hipster trash dabbling in heroin after reading his books. "They're missing the goddamn point," he'd exclaim with disgust. I assiduously avoided junkies up until I landed in San Francisco in the 80s when a good friend and fellow initiate of Aleister Crowley's OTO by the name of Patrick King hooked up with an Exxon heir from Beaumont, Texas, who called himself Pasque. His given name was Waldo, so the alias was understandable. He looked like Mark Bolan. Patrick was a gorgeous blonde guy from Salt Lake City who in every way was God's own Huckleberry Finn until he hooked up with Pasque. Patrick was an innovator, unusually creative for the Crowley crowd. He'd single-handedly resurrected the incredibly obscure 11th degree of the OTO under the authority of Grady McMurtry, the caliph at the time, and opened it to women, an unprecedented and genuinely revolutionary gesture in an organization as phallocentric as the OTO. He initiated me during a visit to New York City in 1980, and I initiated my wife Bonnie shortly thereafter. We were both madly in love with Patrick. The OTO had a well-deserved reputation for drugs and orgies at the time, and we were at Ground Zero, San Francisco, right across the bay from the Berkeley headquarters. It being the 80s, and what with Reagan and Nicaragua and the Contras and the CIA, quality cocaine became abundant and cheap. When Reagan took office in 1981, cocaine was going for $20,000 per kilo in Miami. When he left office, it was priced at $12,000 per kilo. Such was the abundant harvest of CIA operations in Banana Land. I've been in the presence of kilos of cocaine and bricks, uncut. I've always preferred good quality meth. Used judiciously, meth gives more bang for the buck. It's cheaper and it's safer. Even massive doses are rarely fatal. You can be channeling John Belushi for weeks with your blow habit, and one day whiff up a little tiny bump and die. Coke is unpredictable like that. That's why they made Novocaine. There was a weird and very destructive subset of heroin aficionados in the OTO at the time, tiny but elite in rank. It was some kind of macho pose. The dabblers were exclusively male. It had its roots in Crowley's attitude toward heroin, best expressed in his mediocre novel, Diary of a Drug Fiend. It was a boast, shooting heroin and assuming that you can control it. It's akin to that drunk driving thing or fucking with venomous reptiles. For all his blather about will, Crowley couldn't control it. When he died in 1947 at the age of 72, he was shooting enough smack to kill a small room full of people. Patrick had always been an adventurer, a wanderer, hitchhiking around and moving where the Dharma put him. When he hooked up with Paske, everything changed. Paske wanted to settle down and play house, and Junk wasn't going to be the baby. No, and Junk was going to be the baby. They first moved into some crappy motels down near the Marina District. They destroyed the rooms on a weekly basis and moved on to the next one. Just to have the experience, and because they weren't thieves or lowlifes, I shot up with them in one of those motel rooms. It was absolutely horrible in every way. It felt like the flu. No sooner had the shot gone into my main line, but the light shifted all red and smoky, like the light that the Tibetan Book of the Dead warns you about. My skin began to itch, and I felt like I was wrapped in heavy wool. It enhanced nothing. It was pure analgesic and nothing more. Nothing pleasant about it. Unconsciousness in a can. Alcohol is about the journey to oblivion, observing the sights, watching yourself get stupid. Heroin is oblivion. There is no journey. Not long after that, Patrick and Paske were living in absolute squalor in a really nice two-bedroom apartment at California and Hyde on Knob Hill. That's in San Francisco. Bonnie and I were living on the very edge of Chinatown at Bush and Powell. It was an easy walk. Paske got $3,500 on the first of every month from his trust. They had a small entourage of dependent and dedicated junkie followers, partially supported by Paske's fascination with spreading his habit around, and they ran out of money by the third week of every month. Bonnie and I would do a couple of rails of meth on weekends, smoke some pot, and tote a grocery bag full of bread, peanut butter, beans, and rice down to them and hang out with the trust fund junkies. It was bizarre. It all fell apart one day when, in a classic atavistic resurgence of my youthful affiliation with communism, I went off on them both for having achieved an utterly perfect form of reverse alchemy, turning gold into shit, oil into smack. We parted company forever. Patrick and Paske broke up. Patrick went back to his wandering ways and wound up in Prague, where he was beaten to death by the Czechoslovakian police after a fire in his apartment. Paske went off the screens, no doubt back to Beaumont, Texas, to become yet another in the long line of repentant Satanoids, queers, dope fiends, illuminists, saved by the blood of Jesus, and a chick pamphlet or two, the Bejack chick, not to mention continued access to the family fortune. The next junkie I had the misfortune of meeting was a real creep at the Big Apple Circus in 1989, a spotlight operator named Chris. His wife was the production assistant, not a junkie, and he'd suckered her into getting him the job. He convinced her that he was clean. He was glib and slippery, oozing charm from every pore. He was also a thief. He slipped into their sleeper and stole $300 from the hard-working horse grooms, money they'd saved to buy Christmas presents for their folks back home. Circus justice being what it is, he left the show with a broken leg. I argued with Deji about the advice. So he's thinking all this while wondering if he should set his nephew or whatever, or Daisy's son. Right, so he's wondering whether to let Deji let the son come. I argued with Deji about the advisability of inviting a junkie into your home. I pointed out that it's a lot like that common trope in zombie movies where there's always a character who refuses to admit that their loved one has been completely transformed and winds up getting eaten. It was like yelling at a cat. There's no convincing a mother to give up on her son. She'll just have to find out the hard way. I warned her son in no uncertain terms that if he rips her off, he'll be dealt with. Junkies are like flies. They eat shit and bother people. So that's what's happening right now for Mr. Cabal, as he ignores all the ionic stuff we sent him. Well, we think he, maybe not, maybe he's looking into it. Everybody happy with that?
Hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll find out the outcome of it next week.
Yes. So Robert says, is the solar government the same team from Maitreya? No. No issue, Robert. It's not. It's just a bunch of executives. It's the year of the goat. What if there's a link there? No, there's no link. Are there any films, for example, like The Matrix or something like this, that reminds you of these days of servicing Jenny on the block? No. Well, maybe Parallel. What's that called? 1974, Warren Beatty, Parallel something. To look it up. I recommend that film. Let's see.
Hey, Bob, I'm noticing the trend of Alan Cabal.
Trend?
Yeah, trend. It seems to me is that since you sent the email and we've been reading him off, it seems like his stories are not as interesting to hear.
Hear, right.
They're sadder.
Yeah, it seems Bob speaking his name out into the record sort of.
Has snuffed his charisma.
If
Ion looks at this guy, he ain't going to Bob. Okay, buddy. Yeah. Inspiration, the muse will leave you.
Yeah.
Well, it's in and out. It's in and out, though, Bob, because when he goes back to the...
Are you saying he's in and out?
Yeah. The when he starts dreaming about the fuckface article, and he had another one where he went off in that direction, but his stories about himself are on the low side, on the sad side.
Yeah, he's living in negativity, darkness. Yeah, it's an art form, sort of like Bukowski slightly, but shit's happening to him. He's got to put up with the junkie kid. He's like, he's always had aggravation around him. That's what the story's about, right? Endless aggravation,
yeah.
People.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still got the aggravation happening. You should read the one about his sex life in New York in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, he's a golden kid. He was part of all these orgies and things. What do they call that? S&M world. And he describes that and how it leads into the 70s, I mean into the 80s. He touched on it a bit here, but I have to look up what that title was. I'm just trying to find Warren Beatty. The name of that movie is not listing the movies. I have to go to the wiki entry. Parallax, that's what it's called. You guys ever heard of that? Parallax?
Mm-mm.
No.
That's a pretty good movie. Let's see, 1974, The Parallax View. It it came out of the Watergate paranoia. But that was a pretty good documentary on Secret Council 10 reality. Look at that movie. That's pretty gritty, and it's not glamorous like the Matrix. So he then says, Robert says, so then there is a last chance saloon with people there waiting, helping, and researching. Don't know what you mean by that. What do you mean? People waiting, helping, and researching at the Secret Council 10? No, not enough qualifying downs there, Robert.
You know, Bob, I keep going back to Michael's post. No one has a memory of not being.
Yeah, we were pointing that out.
Relating it to not, okay, we don't remember our birth, but we always remember being or beingness.
Yeah, beingness doesn't have an abortion. It has sleep. You know, knockouts. Oh, I don't know what I'm saying. Anybody want to say anything? Go on to some other topics or themes or what? Shall we go home? Call it a day? I'm not going to sit here for the next 6-7 hours not knowing whether Ian's coming back and drag stuff out of you guys.
Bob, have you read any of Philip K. Dick stories?
No, I didn't read him. I can't be bothered. I looked at the books, started looking at them, but I don't particularly like novels.
Hmm.
They're kind of simple.
I like Pynchon, but
I've read a lot about him. I know his themes, and I've read criticism of him. And, you know, I know about how he thinks the Roman Catholic Church has run everything for 2,000 years. We were stuck in a hologram or something.
One of his books is The Man in the High Castle, and the section, well, it's about after the Second World War and the U.S. lost. And it's the United States is divided half Japanese, half of the country, the western half of the U.S., and eastern half of the U.S. is German. There's a little Netflix original on there, one little pilot episode of that. It's pretty interesting.
What, that you're saying that book started to be a TV show?
Yeah, they just made the pilot. I think they're testing it out to see if they'll make more.
Just happened.
Yeah.
Maybe movies about based on his novels are worth watching, like Blade Runner. You know, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
But look at this. You see, you have to realize it's all puny, these scenarios. I've stood on the shoulders of Orion and watched the phalanx of Star Trek vehicles slam into each other. Well, I spent 7,000 hours talking to a fucking fountain of everything. And watched its mood shifts. Mixed in with many JWs being associated with whatever was happening. Whatever was being discussed.
Bob, going back to your explanation last week about there no now and about the technology, and what sparked a thought for me is just the experience of what I'm having, what I think it's called time, as far as how quick the weeks are going. So it made me think, when you made the explanation, it made sense to me, because right now that's basically all we have, the experience that we have on a weekly basis. It's that it's not now, but it is something, and it makes me think that that's the ionic environment slowly seeping into our reality every day.
Yeah, your perceptual apparatus.
Yes.
Not seeping into reality, sleeping into your perceptual apparatus.
Perceptual apparatus, yes. And that's why it made a lot of sense, because this environment that you are in, that you're sharing with us, it was small when you first started cash flow and payday, but it seems to be a lot larger now from my sensory perception in interacting and engaging in this environment. And it seems to me that you have gotten more powerful in the last 6 months.
Yep, I would agree with that.
Just in your interaction with Ion, your interaction when you and Ion come on, it's the duel is on, but it seems that your sword is a lot sharper.
Right. And Ion told me something the other day. I'm not allowed to talk about, but I went to the doctor's office and got appraised. You know, Ion gave me his annual checkup on me.
Okay.
Told me that, well, Bob, you're going where, what is it like? It's fine, we bring up Blade Runner. I have been where no man has been, on the shoulders of Orion. Flaming phalanxes bashing into old Oldsmobiles. Turn left at the Andromeda strain.
Okay.
He told me, and I said, I shouldn't tell anybody that. He said, no, don't tell anybody, Bob. So here I am, telling you, everybody, sort of, with lots of mystery.
But that's all.
My checkup surprised me. I was told new stuff.
Okay. No, but that's always been a long-standing joke between you and Ion, is that Bob will tell everybody.
Yeah. Bob can't keep a secret. I've kept a lot of secrets. I won't tolerate him saying I don't, unless I'm in a jovial mood, because it's not. I have passed all tests of confidentiality. The stuff I've had to hide, it's incredible. The stuff I'd love to tell people is so exciting, so interesting, but I kept it to myself. I lived in solitary confinement, mentally, I guess you'd call it. Or maybe
that's
emotionally.
Hard.
What?
That could be hard.
Well, there's so much going on anyway, so we can forget about it. I can tell you about all kinds of other stuff.
Yeah, you still have to keep it to yourself. There's more. There is. There's a bunch, and you're going to have to keep it to yourself for a lot longer.
Yeah, for a long time. Certainly would explain a lot if we could release it. Certainly would clarify.
I wanted to ask
Ion
if the second season of the event is in 2015, if it's this year.
Yeah.
He said the event was coming back.
Right. It wasn't that, you know, pictorially wasn't that great a show. It was a bit cheap. Cheaply made.
Oh, you know what else I noticed last week, Bob? You know how Ion makes a distinction between being immortal and being eternal?
Yeah.
Last week he was responding to something Doug had said, and he said, you're immortal whether you embrace it or not. You're immortal whether you like it or not. And I know with immortals, he said, what, vampires are immortal? And what else? Watchers are immortals, and immortals don't ascend. Those are just a few things he's said about being immortals. But he said that we're eternal, didn't he?
What's that? Last bit?
Hasn't he said that we're eternal?
Yes. Immortal is not the right term, but you said last week he was using the word immortal as if it was eternal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was responding to something Doug had said, and he said, well, you're immortal whether you embrace it or not. You're immortal whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
So you write me an email. I said, Bob, you were rather grumpy last week. I don't think I'm grumpy.
Oh, I said, hey, grumpy.
Yeah, he called me grumpy. Now, I don't have emotions of being grumpy. I'm just fucking pissed off at the incompetence around me. Okay, that's not grumpy. That's like Zappa conducting the band. Hey, don't fuck up on that riff there. You know, you play it right. It's like precision. It's passion. It's not grumpy. Oh, I didn't get enough sleep last night. I'm in a bad mood. I don't get in bad moods. So I object to that term, grumpy.
I think it was during the Bill's Hour last week. I had barely talked because I was doing things last weekend. And
right.
When I started to talk during Bill's Hour, you're like, where the hell were you? And
yeah.
What were you doing all since you've been on
all those hours?
Where were you? Yeah, all those hours. And I was like, well, I was sleeping for most of the time and this and that, and you weren't having it.
No, I said, I knew you probably were. And I just said, you know, how come you're keeping your phone on? I kind of accepted. I just wanted to know whether, I wanted to get clarified. Here your phone was there all along for many hours and you didn't say anything. So I said, you must be sleeping. So I said, what were you doing? And you said you were sleeping. That's all.
I was sleeping, but you did sound grumpy as if you were just up for talking for so many hours.
Well, it was stupid if you were on there and never said a word all those hours.
But I was
sleeping.
When
I found out you were sleeping.
So I wasn't awake, yeah.
Yeah, when I found out you were asleep, which is what I suspected, that was, you know, okay. But, Chad, you ever heard me being grumpy, Chad?
No. You don't get grumpy. You don't get any grumpy moods. It's like it's like you're a passionate coach of a basketball team or something, and you're trying to hold people to standards.
That's
exactly.
Right. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Demanding. You can be demanding.
Yeah. You always demand. Yeah, exactly, Bob. You always demand more once people get out of one layer into the next.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not grumpy. That's demanding. Like any respectable coach, you know, he harasses the team member to, and some of them do it wrong, but he basically harassed the team to do better.
Yeah, and some people cry when that happens.
Yeah. They get fired from the team. Who the fuck would cry? No fucking patriarchal jock would cry. That's for girls.
They just disappear. They just disappear for a while.
Yeah.
It's like Michael Brown. He needs to come back in and get his whipping by the coach and just start playing.
Yeah,
but nobody really knows what the reason was for Michael Brown to leave. So. All those were
no, we don't know what he is humiliated by. I think Katie was told something about it, but I don't know the details. But, like, you know, he's sneaking in and typing little musical messages to us. You know, come on. It's like, what?
I think he's the only one that wasn't, you know, the things weren't said to you that were maybe hard on the ego.
Yeah, somehow he got insulted. Like, I'm not in power. What is it? I'm not an authority figure. There's no consequences of pissing me off. I don't have any leeway over anybody. Maybe I could deny them access to Ion.
Yeah, like, you got, for example, Keith on Five Body, the way that he used to come at you, Bob, and you still never responded in a grumpy way or anything.
No.
Like,
oh,
either ignored him or did something.
Or you'd give him a fact. He'd attack you, and then you'd come back with some
fact. Bob, you had way too much patience with him.
Now, wait a minute. Chad, you're real muffled. So fix that. Fucking tie your skate, for fuck's sake. Don't go out there with a loose skate. You fucking... And then what did she say? I was way too tolerant of Kiki? You don't question the judge. You needed fucking exercise in that quadrant. You need to put up with an asshole for all the hours that, you know. There's no way to it. It was way too much for you, Eliza. Not for anybody else or for me or anybody. It's you. You're the one who found your limit.
Well.
But you want me to smack him down? I let him go because he, you guys had to experience that. And then I stopped him. I wasn't out of control. I wasn't making a whatever a silliness out of it. I eventually muted him all the time.
Yeah, you were conducting. You let him play it solo a couple of times, and you shut it down, and you open back up, let him do it solo.
I even said, yeah. He said, look, come on, do it right. Don't ask your bullshit shit, and he wouldn't do it. He'd sneak in and ask Ion some ridiculous question about Japanese vegetarians in Samoa, you know?
What is
the ratio of lesbians to Japanese vegans in Samoa, Bob? And is it, well, should I go to North Korea? What do you think, Bob? I think I set a record for the number of emails I've ignored from him. He sent me lots of emails through the years that I never answered. I can be sober. What is it? I respect him. But this, I'm not letting this fucking fly that eats shit. Alan Cabal, I quote Alan, the great master, Alan Cabal, the great grump. That is a grumpy guy. It's fucking Alan Cabal. That's grumpy. That guy is grumpy, man. Now we know what he is. And you're right, celebrate
him.
Yeah,
him because you said it. Because you said it now, so now he's going to spiral even further down the hole.
Yeah. It's interesting. Bob's laser beam is on him, and I don't even have to do nothing. I just have to pay attention, do my part, listen to his, read his column, and then offer dialogue. And he doesn't fucking dialogue. Oh, I wouldn't want to be Alan. Oh, you know, Bob's here to be friendly. And you don't want to be friendly for some neurotic fetish about fucked up orgies in 1979 in the Drumbo part of Manhattan? Well, okay, go ahead. Be my guest. I'm turning into a Clint Eastwood here. What Roxy thought I was.
That's right, yeah. Make my universe.
But that was pretty good description of junkiness. I'd never seen that before. That was pretty honest. Sounded terrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like, he's been around a lot of sleazy people. Now, you know, Chad, I give him great credit. He's the one that said, that's what drew my attention to him back 10 years ago. He said, Marshall McLuhan is the Andy Warhol of big science. You remember me saying that years ago? You ever hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the guy who said it. And he's well-read, you know. He read a lot of stuff. And he's capable of making, he almost knows the importance of his statement.
Yeah, that's interesting. The Andy Warhol of big science, is that in regard to, like, how McLuhan used to go in and speak, like, in front of IBM?
Right. Yeah, like, he took on the big concepts, the elite, the technocratic elite, you know, the quantum physicists, and he categorized the effects on them. He wasn't talking like Ebert and Siskel, talking about local movies. You know, he took on the big techno elites and critiqued them. Now, how is he Andy Warhol? You know, that's interesting. What part of Warhol would that be? A put-on artist? Warhol said he'd rather be a machine. Well, maybe McLuhan people thought that he was embracing the cyborg too much. How they
Well, Warhol was featuring the artwork of the machines, like the Campbell soup can. It's like, oh, look what the machine made, putting a frame around it, which is kind of like what McLuhan did with the big media.
Right.
The frame
which
around
reminds me, I do have some homework for you guys. This is what I want to read. This is a really good book, Harold Innes's Empire and Communications. Now, he has six chapters or six phases, and he writes really good introductions to them. So I want to read a couple of these introductions. This is like a good synopsis of history as we know it. So in the Egyptian section, it says, Empires are difficult structures to create and maintain. A number of dynamic forces have to be linked together in a manner that permits evolution and maintains stability. Harold Innes uses Egypt as his first case study, noting carefully that, in terms of efficiency, Egypt was not a particularly successful empire. And he has a quote from page 22. This is the editor, David Godfrey, writing an introduction to the Innes chapter. So he quotes page 22 of the section on Egypt. And it says, a successful empire required adequate appreciation of problems of space that were in part military and political, and of problems of time that were in part dynastic and biological and in part religious. So if you have a successful empire, you got to understand space and you got to understand time in media terms. The two media that dominated Egyptian communications were stone and papyrus. Stone, as shown in the role of the pyramids, was linked to the political power of absolute monarchs. The pharaohs, however, were successors of Horus and Osiris, and their political role had a strong religious component. So that's stone. Papyrus was linked more directly to the priesthood and provided them with a means for increasing democracy by breaking down the power of the autocratic monarchy. As the priestly class expanded their power, they played a stronger political role in the management of lands and social life. Innes notes that initially the transition from stone to papyrus weakened Egypt and permitted incursions from other empires and nations, but that an eventual fusion between the monarchy and the priesthood led not only to the expulsion of the invaders, but to the creation of an Egyptian empire that included Syria and Jerusalem. However, a monopoly control of communications by religious forces worked as an internal brake on the efficiency of this empire. Read that again. However, a monopoly control of communications by religious forces worked as an internal brake on the efficiency of this empire. For the Egyptians, writing was essentially religious, not legal, commercial, or philosophic, as in the later empires Innes examines. In this chapter, Innes stresses the continuing role of the deity Thoth, you know, he's the guy who did the Emerald Tablets, as the inventor of language and script and the defender of scribes. Thoth's role changed with the evolving social dynamics, but he remained a powerful force as dynasties came and went. Egyptian writing remained complex in form and structure through the slow rise and fairly rapid fall of its empire. This complexity gave the scribes power and position. It linked priests and scribes in a self-protecting monopolistic administrative network that weakened the power of the kings and limited evolutionary social changes. For example, the attempts of Akhenaten to introduce a monotheistic emperor-supporting religion were defeated by this continuing bureaucracy. A culture was created which was not successful in its imperial form, but which had a toughness and resilience that made invasion by the Assyrian and Persian empires difficult. Another continuing force which Innes describes in some detail was the Nile. The river provided some geographic centrality for Egypt, which was lacking in other areas. Control of the Nile required scientific knowledge of a fairly specialized kind. The development and improvement of the calendar provided support for both the monarchy and the priesthood and helped strengthen the emphasis on writing as an expression of religion and magic. The emphasis on writing in Egypt produced a large, powerful, and enduring class of scribes closely allied with religious forces. Their monopoly over communication survived the introduction of papyrus, and limited the growth of empire. Problems of space were not fully resolved, given the heavy emphasis on problems of time. However, democratic, literary, religious, and scientific innovations received some support, and the society remained resistant to foreign invasions. The resiliency of what was created remains evident today in the long history of the Egyptian state. Many of the empires with which it did battle at various times have left no trace beyond the historical. So, that gives you a little run-through of the factors in the Old Testament times that was going on around David and those guys.
It's funny because...
Pretty easy to follow?
What?
Pretty easy to follow?
Yeah, you know what it was like for me? It was like you were commentating on a football game or something, but it was
right.
The interplay between those different extensions.
Yeah, Dallas and Chicago invaded Montreal, but because they had a balanced coast and got RNA drops, They live in the Pirates. They stood in for the long haul. They weren't perfect. They didn't buy magnesium, and they weren't using much Realign. But all in all, they did get to show up to be excluded from the sex vessels when the sex goddess came in the final days of July 5th, 2020.
Hey, Bob, 2 weeks ago you asked Ion to comment on something that you read from Harold Innes regarding Egypt.
Yeah.
But I can't remember what you asked him, but it was pretty significant. Does anyone remember?
I was asking about the word, the creation of the word. That's a pretty interesting section.
Bob, I was trying to find what you were reading. I've got the book open. And
like it's online?
Yep. I'm just having a wonderful time finding books online. This is in Gutenberg.ca, their e-book.
Yeah, right.
But, crap, where'd it go now? The power of the spoken word in chapter 3, the oral tradition in Greek civilization. There's a section where it says Greek
Judge
civilization
Kadir?
Was...
Where is that? Let me see. What chapter? Egypt?
Yeah, number 3.
Well, what's number 3?
The oral tradition and Greek civilization.
Yeah, that's not Egypt. That's Greece. Okay, what about it? What part of it?
If you search, I searched Toth, T-H-O-T-H.
Yeah, what's the section titled? The subsection.
It's just a few paragraphs down. It's just a few paragraphs down from the header of chapter 3, The Oral Tradition in Greek Civilization. It's 1, 2, 3... 4, 5
part
paragraphs
about stone
down.
And clay, 4, 5, 6, stone and clay, writing versus monopolies.
He says, Socrates in Phaedrus reports a conversation between Thoth, the inventor of letters, and the god Ammon.
Thoth.
Thoth.
I don't see Socrates. See, these guys may have put extra, they re-edited the book, they may have extra... stuff, but
I was having
called,
trouble finding.
Like, do you have the title "Greece Spoken versus Written"? Subtitle: Limits to Understanding, Limits to Wisdom, Plato's Dialogues, Aristotle's Notes. You see those kind of categories? I don't think so.
Hold on, I didn't want to lose the spot, but let me go back up and see here.
Well, there's this part about